Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 188.LU2101, certificate number 39770, the Carnegie Libraries.
The millionaire will be but the trustee for the poor, entrusted for a season with a part of the increased wealth of the community, but administering it for the community.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, we had a nice little conversation before the episode, and we tried not to just start talking about the episode like five different times during the intro. But to fill in, you're reporting to us from South Bend, Indiana, where you work or have worked with one of my high school classmates.
That's right. Rick Garnett, our mutual friend.
You are a lawyer, but not a lawyer.
Correct. I have law degrees, but never practiced law. College administrator, professor. So I'm teaching a course about philanthropy and nonprofits.
And do you feel like philanthropy was something that was in your household growing up? Like, where did your parents have, if not like a philanthropic bent of their own, did you live in a world in which philanthropy was talked about around the dinner table?
I would say for me growing up, so I'm a Gen Xer only by about 3 months. If I were born a few months later, I would not be, but I'm very proud to be a Gen Xer. And so I claim it. Yeah. I think growing up in the 80s and the 90s in the Midwest, even if you were middle class, there was still very much an idea that you owe others and you have to give back to society. So I think that was at least a part of my growing up. I mean, I wasn't in a wealthy family. There was no family foundation, but even if you could do a little, that was certainly always encouraged.
And you probably meet so many more young people than I do, or that most of our listeners do, who aren't in academics. Do you think that idea that we have a responsibility to give back is like still a shared sense, or do you think that that's been lost? Because I imagine if we went on the internet right now and posted something about it, there'd be 10,000 angry comments from people claiming that the young people have no, or that the world has gone to hell. But you see it right up close.
I see it up close. I think overall, if you look at the data, you look at the trends, even if you look at it anecdotally, I think young people do want to give back. And like any generation before them, they want to know that the world was a better place with them having been here, right? I think that the main thing that you might see now is that young people, because of inflation, especially related to things like housing, makes it harder to sort of start that American dream, right? And so that just makes it naturally more difficult to give back, but young people still want to give back both their money, but also their time. So you'll see young people volunteering at pretty healthy rates. So they're doing their part there. Now, the question still is to be seen when young people who are now in their 20s or 30s, when they eventually have more wealth, when they're maybe a little bit older in their 40s and 50s, are they going to give back? I mean, we don't know yet. Also, the other trend is young people are maybe more likely and receptive to giving directly to people in need. That's partly the rise of things like GoFundMe, where you can help out someone in distress right now or in need, as opposed to maybe giving to an organization, which was sort of philanthropy you know, the majority of philanthropy for a long time was people giving directly to just vetted nonprofits that they liked.
Yeah, that was kind of devastating. There was a controversy at some point with the United Way and how much they were spending on not giving money to people. And we had always given to the United Way as a family, just as one of the, you know, the things that we supported. And it really, my mom especially, just shocked and horrified her. And that was, yeah, a little moment of loss of faith.
Yeah, a lot of overhead sometimes at United Way. I think they've done things to sort of change that and combat that narrative. But just like giving to some organizations, the overhead can be high. Now, high overhead isn't always bad by itself, but you need to really study up on your nonprofits, get to know the leadership, and make sure that you feel comfortable with your giving because you work hard for your money and you want to make sure that it goes to the best nonprofit that serves the causes that you believe in.
So you don't feel that the young people, I mean, one of the challenges, I guess, of having a world that's less affordable and there seems to be, you know, a constriction on the paths forward for young people is that it might tend to breed cynicism. Do you see that cynicism, or is that just a kind of one of these like, oh, the kids all got A's and they don't have any stick-to-itiveness? You know, is it one of those narratives that just feels very boomer Twitter, or do you actually feel there's cynicism in the kids?
I mean, I do not see the cynicism anecdotally as a professor, and I don't see it in my child who is now 17. I really don't see that. I do see them looking to find the right appropriate ways and the best measures to make the world best and to support the public good. I see that. I just think that they struggle from a resources perspective. I'm sure that there is some cynicism, but in my little bubble, I don't really encounter that.
Well, as a scholar at a Catholic school, you also have to have a pretty complex understanding of the way that often it is the poorer people who give more. I mean, your biblical verse even references it, but it's often those who have the least that are the most giving to the community. You know, they are giving a larger proportion of what they own away. And is that something that you still see? Is that still present in our culture? It's not just it takes a village. I mean, it's actual contribution of money and resources to people.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, the biblical verse that you mentioned in our pre-show taping is the widow's mite, where the widow gives her two, I think, copper pennies to the temple, and for her that was, you know, a lot of money. And Jesus says, well, she gave the most because she gave proportionally, you know, a lot for her. It's always been true. If you look at the data now, the last century, even beyond, you're right that lower income people and lower net worth families are going to give more proportionately to charity than the ultra wealthy. That is absolutely true. I think it's always been true. There's different reasons why. I mean, part of it could just be lower income or middle class people tithing, even giving 10% to your church or something like that. That's going to be a lot more than many wealthy people give. And we'll talk about, you know, Carnegie in a moment. Sometimes wealthy people, they like to keep their money until they die. It might be, it could be an estate gift. It could be given to a foundation.
Tell.
Yeah. So that happens quite a bit. But yeah, middle class and lower income people are going to proportionally give more than the ultra wealthy. Some people with less means may be inclined or motivated to give because of what religion or Christianity tells them. Of course, we know that. But even still so, lower income people today, we have a more secular society, they know what it's like to struggle and to go without. And so even if there is, again, this, we're learning this in real time, this is new as we become more secular, it seems that lower income people are more likely to give even without the religious background because they want to help someone that was in their position last year or last month even. Like, they know what it's like to struggle to fill up your car with gas. They know what it's like to maybe not have enough for groceries. So it seems like they're still giving. Again, time will tell how much of a factor religion played. That's for the social scientists to look at maybe a decade or two from now.
That's what we're doing here. The Omnibus Project is essentially a social science research project. that is populated by fallen lawyers and former librarians, mostly in the Midwest of the United States, reporting in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do you feel that philanthropy throughout history was primarily religiously motivated, or is philanthropy the impulse to give something more complex in the human condition?
I think it's very often had a very serious tie and connection to religion, right? Because certain scriptures are telling us to tithe either directly to the church, or you have a mandate as a believer to help the poor, right? And I think it's a hard question to answer in some part because the modern market economy doesn't really, you know, go online until a few centuries ago. So historically, you know, what a peasant would have faced in 13th century Europe is much different than, you know, what a middle class American is facing today. But there's often been a religious duty to give back. I think of virtually, obviously, any major religion, there's a duty to give back and help those less fortunate. Again, we'll see sort of how that continues in a changing world.
Yeah, right. In a post-enlightenment world like the one we're living in, or an enlightenment world and then post-enlightenment world.
Consider that a lot of people haven't really had discretionary income. You know, like the masses haven't had that until the last, you know, what 100, 200 years. For the most part, it was you worked, you had what little you had, you know, and now things have changed and we have a consumer society where people have the luxury almost sometimes to give back. And for some people, it can be the click of a button or tapping a phone screen. And so it's become easier to give than it ever has, which is a good thing. My class, we're experiential learning and we're tasked with actually awarding grants to local nonprofits. So that's taking a lot of the time. I have 35 hours over the semester with my students. I'm trying to cover what I can as far as the philosophy and the history, but it just goes by so fast.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you came into this topic?
Yeah, I mean, I've been teaching a class on philanthropy and the common good now for over 7 years, going into the eighth year. And so fell into it that way as both an administrator and a practitioner and a fundraiser and with a background in law. And so that got me into the academic world of studying philanthropy, which isn't a massive, you know, set of people. It's relatively small.
Right.
So I've been teaching the class, and that led me to do some deep dives into the history of philanthropy. And I think the most exciting and interesting story, at least in American philanthropy, really is Andrew Carnegie. And I had a question for you. John, you enjoy a good trip to a library, don't you?
I do. I do.
Yeah, I listened to Omnibus for years, and I've heard you on more than a few occasions mention libraries, and I thought, have I got a story for John? And I'm sure you know that the industrialist and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie played a major role in building libraries across the United States.
He did.
But yeah, I bet that some Omnibus listeners are unaware just how major that role was, and I bet that you will be surprised to learn what state the Carnegie Libraries are in today.
Well, what's crazy is that Seattle has, I think, 6 Carnegie Libraries that are still, they still all are used as libraries. Oh, with the exception of maybe one.
Well, that might be the punchline for the whole episode, so don't okay. Spill it yet. There's okay. One in Ballard that
Ballard
we're going to talk
one,
about.
That's right.
Well, don't tell the okay. Don't tell the future lanes just yet, right. But that's one of the punchlines.
That was the one I was going to mention. But yeah, the other ones like University One and
yeah.
Green Lake and Columbia City, they all are still, and they're beautiful. They're beautiful libraries.
They really are, yeah. I mean, we'll talk about numbers later in the episode, but Washington State had 44 Carnegie Libraries.
You're kidding me. So, why?
I'm
why would
kidding.
He have cared about Washington in that way? Or what was the what well, his, circumstances?
His libraries were across the nation. They were in almost every state and territory. And so, again, we'll get into numbers, but he builds, you know, over 1,600 of them.
You're
and so it's
me.
They're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. And so Washington is no exception. They're worthy of libraries in Washington.
Hell yes, we are.
Can we talk just for a moment about Carnegie's childhood and upbringing? Because it's really going to help futurelings understand Carnegie as a man and how he acquired this wealth, but also help them understand why he decided to give a lot of this money away.
So he was Scottish.
He was Scottish. So he's born in Dunfermline, Scotland in 1835. And his father was William Carnegie. Now, in Scotland, they would have pronounced the surname Carnegie.
Right.
But like many Americans, you know, they change pronunciations or spellings, in this case, just the pronunciation. So they go from Carnegie to Carnegie. And his mother was named Margaret. And he was born in this small stone bungalow. And it was really just a room in a small attic. And in that house, William, he worked as a weaver. And
his
he
father.
Owned a hand... His father, yeah, William was his father. He was a weaver and had a hand loom, and it sat in the house. And he made fine linen cloth. And again, Andrew was born in that small bungalow. And times were pretty good, and a year later, they moved to a somewhat bigger house. But Andrew is able to start attending school at age 8. And he gets to go to the free school in Dunfermline, Scotland. And the school was a gift to the town by a judge and philanthropist named Adam Rowland, okay?
So a non-religious school.
I believe so. I don't know if there was an attachment to a Presbyterian, you know, teaching or not, but the point is there's a philanthropist that gives the money, and that allows Andrew at 8 to actually have some kind of formal education. But Andrew develops a love for reading. He had a couple uncles on his maternal side, and they were just, we'll call them political activists.
Okay.
And they loved reading books, and Andrew loved them, and he picked up reading from these uncles. But the good times for the Carnegie family, they don't last forever. So I mentioned a moment ago, William, the father, he's a solo weaver who looms by hand, and now we're in the early 1840s. John, can you guess what might happen to William and his trade in Scotland in the 1840s as a weaver?
The 1840s as a weaver, well, he's probably making kilts to attack the British. And I guess in the 1840s, the railroad,
It's not the railroad. It's the textile factories. Industrialization at a massive scale, right?
Right.
And now William, again, the father, he could have took a job at the factory, but out of pride, he decides not to.
Hear, hear. And, stand up for your rights, right? Home weaver.
But it really set the family back financially. It was really, really bad. Now, Andrew's mother, Margaret, she steps up. And for the rest of her life, she will be very close to Andrew and involved in a lot of what he does in his whole life. In fact, at one point, Andrew promises his mother that he will not marry until she passes away.
Oh, my goodness.
And he kept that promise, and he married much later in life and had kids much later in life because of this promise that he made to Margaret.
That seems like a strange promise to make your mother.
I agree. That is very, very strange. But we're learning about who he was and the man and how his childhood shaped him, okay?
All right.
Now, Andrew's mother's maiden name was Morrison. Mm-hmm. And her brother, Tom Morrison, was one of those fiery political uncles I talked about a second ago, okay? Mm-hmm. He made a lot of enemies around town because he's talking about labor rights and the working class, and people don't like him. Now, from Andrew's bedroom, he could see this beautiful estate called Pittencrieff Estate. And it's this beautiful place in town, and every year the owner invites the public to the grounds to stroll the gardens. And it's this amazing thing. It's like the county fair version of Andrew Carnegie's childhood. And there's games and there's food and all these good times. But the owner, he barred anyone from this annual event who was related to a Morrison.
So, and is he an aristocrat or is he just a wealthy industrialist?
I think he's an aristocrat, but he has this massive estate. So I don't think he's an industrialist, although he could have been, right? But again, he's inviting the whole town over for the big party of the year.
Oh, man.
But if you're related to a Morrison or you are a Morrison, you're not welcome.
Oh, how bad.
So Andrew, young Andrew had to stand outside and watch all of his friends play and enjoy a day at this beautiful park.
Oh,
and it, really, I think this experience really does influence the way that Carnegie thinks about things like equality, but also access to spaces. Okay.
Right. Well, and also, like, I mean, nothing is going to make me want to start a steel mill more than a desire to have revenge against a Scottish aristocrat.
Oh, well, we're going to get there, don't
worry. For excluding me from his birthday party. Omnibus Futurelings know that I'm a longtime booster of Mint Mobile. And Mint Mobile right now is having a summer sale. All of their plans are $15 a month, even unlimited wireless plans for $15 a month through Mint Mobile. Omnibus has long encouraged people to free themselves from big wireless and all of their pricing plan gimmicks and gotchas and switch to Mint Mobile for high-speed data and coverage on the T-Mobile 5G network. Mint Mobile took what's wrong with wireless and made it right for premium wireless for only $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data, unlimited talk and text. You can bring your current phone number and your current phone and choose between 3, 6, or 12-month plans to say goodbye to your monthly bill. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile. It's so easy to sign up online, get 3 months of premium wireless service for only $15 a month. This is a very cool summer sale, and I highly recommend Mint Mobile for you and all of your loved ones. So to get a new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/omnibus. mintmobile.com/omnibus, mintmobile.com/omnibus. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month, and there's no catch. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, that's $15 a month, or $90 for 6 months, that's $15 a month, or $180 for 12 months, that's $15 a month. One of these three plans is required. Taxes and fees are extra. Initial plan term only, greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable devices required. You can't do this, I don't think, with your LG flip phone. No offense to those of you who are still rocking your LG flip phones. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com for details.
Now, the times don't get any easier. Eventually, Andrew's younger brother, Tom, is born in 1843, and there's one more mouth to feed. And Andrew's mother says, enough of this, we're going to America.
Really?
So they emigrate and move the entire family to Allegheny, Pennsylvania in 1848. Now, at this time, Andrew is 12. And off they go on all things. I think that you'll appreciate this, John. They sail on a converted whaling ship named the Wiscasset on a 50-day journey to New York.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Oh.
And from there, it's also an arduous journey just to get to Allegheny, Pennsylvania, right? They have to take steamer ships and all this stuff. Like, it's a long, long journey.
I have a brief question. I guess we're going to get to this, I'm sure. But is the reason that Allegheny, Pennsylvania, and that part of Pennsylvania is the heart of the steel industry in the United States in the 19th century, just because the Carnegies moved there because there was like she had some cousin or something? I always assumed that it was because of water power or there was something about the region or the environment that made it ideal for steel making. But you're saying it was just where they landed. It could have been anywhere.
They landed. They had relatives already in Allegheny. Now, Pittsburgh does, of course, have access to rivers, and there's a large immigrant population, which is supplying the labor, you know, the cheap labor to have all this industry. But I don't know exactly why, if Allegheny would have been destined to be the future site of steel or not, if Margaret Carnegie does not move there in the 1840s.
I just love the way that this is all playing out, because it often is this, right? That just somebody happens to be somewhere and somebody else, you know, drops an apple and all of a sudden here we are and it's U.S. Steel. So anyway,
I think Andrew Carnegie would have been successful no matter where he landed, and we'll get a better sense of that as we keep going. So, just to note, he really did not want to leave Scotland. He recalls crying, leaving his hometown, and of course, what young person wants to leave their hometown and go to a new country?
And he was just a teenager, young. He was young,
Right. He's 12, 13 at this time. Now, they had relatives, like I said, in Allegheny, and they end up settling in a slum neighborhood called Slab Town. So, again, they're not going to, this isn't the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, right? Okay. Like, they're on hard times. So, Andrew, again, he's 13, and his formal education, it's over. There's no more formal education for Carnegie, and that's unfortunate because he loved school, he loved reading, he loved ideas and so many ways. And he needs to take a job and support the family. So he gets a job paying $1.20 per week in a boiler room. And it's a boiler room of a thread factory. And in addition to working in the boiler room, he's also changing spools of thread. He's probably working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, right? It's hard and it's stressful and it's dangerous. And also, boilers, especially back in 1848, they were known to explode from time to time, right? Yeah. So,
but also, isn't this insulting to him at some level, having come up as the son of a weaver to be like part, like a cog in the machine of the very industry that changed their fortunes? It must have been.
Oh, absolutely. It had to be. And so not only that, but just the stress that he'd be put under, because if he makes a mistake, he could harm himself, but also people around him, right? It's an incredibly unimaginable thing for us now to think of a 13-year-old subjected to that kind of job. Now, Andrew's father, William, does, in fact, he comes with the family. He does, for a brief period, work at that same factory. He eventually concedes, and he says, I'll work. But he doesn't work there very long, from what records show. And he would eventually die not many years later in 1855. So he did, for a period, work at the same factory with Andrew. Now, Andrew gets a lucky break. He gets a job as a messenger with the Pittsburgh office of the Ohio Telegraph Company. Mm-hmm. Not a great job, but certainly much better than being in a boiler room, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the job allows Andrew to learn all about local business, to meet people. And because he's a messenger delivering telegrams, he kind of knows what's happening in the community. He knows what's happening in the business world, right?
And this is still before the Civil War.
This is, and we'll talk in just a moment about Andrew in the Civil War, because he plays a part.
Oh.
Now, when he's not running messages for the telegraph company, and now he's maybe 14, 15, he starts watching the telegraph machine, and he's able to understand how it works so well, in fact, that they make him an operator.
Uh-huh.
Now, during this time, I should just note for a second, during Andrew's spare time, he's also pursuing intellectual things. He's in a debate society. He's still reading a lot of books. He's trying to get books wherever he can. That's often from wealthy individuals that might, lend him a book. At this time, a private library a private library could be found, but a public library, you really wouldn't see. You would see them sometimes in New England, in New York. But for most Americans at that time, there was little access to books, and the idea of a building that you could walk into and borrow a book for free was really a foreign concept, right?
Wait, is that really true? Is that true in the United Kingdom? Where did the idea of a public library originate?
I mean, there's some public libraries throughout British history, of course, but they're not in every town. It wouldn't be every town had a library. A small town wouldn't have a public library. They might have a society library where people would pay dues to have access to the books, right?
Right.
But the idea that the library belongs to the town and has what Carnegie would eventually call access for all, that's really not a thing. And keep in mind, in colonial America and early American history, libraries are tied sometimes to parishes, especially to Anglican parishes, right? Eventually, I think Boston has a free public library early. Of course, Benjamin Franklin loves libraries, and you see those in Pennsylvania. But the idea that we have now, where every public town, of course, like, go to the library, like, that's just like taken for granted. At this time, that's not really a thing. Now, for Andrew at this moment, there is a library in Pittsburgh, and basically, Andrew loved to go to the library, but it was still what I would call a private library for the most part. Mm-hmm. And he was allowed to go, but eventually one day he was turned away from the library.
Of the Morrisons, not again.
Not because of the Morrisons, no, they're long gone. But it's because Andrew is what they call a working child, and he's a school child. Yeah, they say, Andrew, you're a working child, you're not enrolled in school. And it used to be you could come here every Saturday, but now you no longer can.
Was this a man's living room type of library or a parish library? What was the library connected to?
Yeah, I think it's a library in town, but it's, again, it's private. I don't know the location. It would have been in Pittsburgh. And again, he let school children use it one day per week.
I see.
But then again, eventually he was turned away because he was, again, a working child.
Yes.
But Andrew, he decides to write a letter to the newspaper. And he says, hey, this library was funded by a donor. And my interpretation is that he intended for this library to be open to all children, regardless if they worked or not. And it works. They respond to his letter, the library, they say, you can come here. And so Andrew learns that the power of the pen can really pay off, right? Now, I want to just jump forward a few years later to keep going. I want to get to the libraries, right? But now Andrew is 18. It's 1853. And a guy named Thomas A. Scott offers Andrew a job with the Pennsylvania Railroad as a telegraph operator and secretary. Because again, Andrew learned how to use telegraphs. He knows how to use all these machines.
That's a cool job.
And it pays $4 a week, which is substantial, not enough to support a family by any means, but it's decent money, okay? And Andrew sees this as a good prospect and a good reason to take the job. And of course, he was right. We know our history. The railroad industry in the 1850s was a really good career bet, right?
Yeah.
So much so that by 1859, Andrew is promoted to superintendent, and he's now making $1,500 per year. So he's making good money now, and he's able to hire his little brother that came with them. And so the family is stable. And at this time, Andrew is also investing in companies because he knows a lot about commerce. He knows what's what, and he's also making even more money off of his investments. You mentioned the Civil War. Do you want to get into the Civil War and Andrew Carnegie?
Do I ever?
Okay. Now, Andrew joins the U.S. Military Telegraph Corps. It was a thing. I was surprised to learn that myself.
I believe it.
And he assisted with telegraph lines and railways for the Union Army. So he's on the right side.
Of course.
He's on the right side, and he's doing his part.
Right.
And he even once joked that he was the first casualty of the Battle of Bull Run because, and it's hard to understand what happened exactly, but he was trying to free some trapped telegraph wire, and he was confronting Southern sympathizers, and this wire snapped, and it hits him across the face, and he has a scar on his cheek. I don't think it was very noticeable, but he had it, you know, for the rest of his life. So Andrew was part of the Civil War with the telegraphs. He had a scar on his face because of his service. He was not in infantry. But he also learned from the Civil War just how apparent industry and commerce was to the Union victory. It was apparent when the dust settled, like, wow, the North, they have the industry, they have the power, they have the machinery. And that was really what helped them win the war, right? So moving out of the Civil War, Andrew founds what's called the Keystone Bridge Company. And he starts producing the steel right after the Civil War. And he makes a comment at one point. He says publicly, I propose to take an income no greater than $50,000 per annum. Beyond this, I need ever earn, make no effort to increase my fortune, but spend the surplus each year for benevolent purposes. So at a still a relatively young age and nowhere near the massive wealth that he'll get in the coming decades, he's thinking about wealth and he's thinking about ethically how much should he spend and how much should he give back to the community, right? So this is a really important part of Carnegie's upbringing in his early adult years.
Well, so when he started this company, this figure, $50,000, would have been obviously an extraordinary amount of money at the time, but did he arrive at that figure because of anything? It seems like very, very hopeful that you would ever have a company that made you that much money. Was he didn't go from $1,500 a year to $50,000 with the start of his company.
There would have been a gradual increase in pay, but of course the Civil War disrupted everything. I think the main point is that coming out of the Civil War, again, he founds this Keystone Bridge Company. He sees a path to build bridges, literal bridges that can accommodate the railroads. And he sees a merging of all the technology that he knows about in a way to really capitalize like never before. I don't know how he got to that $50,000 number. You are correct. It was a large sum of money, right? It was more than most people could even think about spending. By this time, Carnegie moved with his mother to New York City, okay? And they've entered high society. And so now he's, you know, getting into being in his 30s. He's financially set. Whereas most people in the Gilded Age, the wealthiest people, were thinking about acquiring more money. And Andrew was certainly still industrious. Andrew Carnegie was still thinking about ideas. And he loved to gather smart people to dinners, into conversations. In fact, he befriends Mark Twain and other well-known writers. So he really is, in his own right, an intellectual. And it's not hard to think of a different universe where Carnegie is born into a different situation and he becomes a professor at the University of Edinburgh, right? Like, it's not hard at all to imagine that for Carnegie. But again, that those weren't the cards that he was dealt.
So during the Gilded Age, did he experience a lot of prejudice based on the fact that I'm sure his accent was working class, his manners probably took a while to catch up? Like, was he denigrated in the press as being an upstart or a greenhorn?
I don't think so. I think it was still a nation very much of immigrants at that time, especially, you know, from Europe. And being from Scotland and having, you know, spoken English, it wouldn't have been too hard for him to assimilate. And I don't know how much his accent stayed with him, but he's navigating things just fine, as far as we can tell. I've just watched a few documentaries. I don't recall him feeling so much as being an outsider, because, you know, there were whole neighborhoods of Scottish immigrants and of German immigrants. And there wasn't really, you know, a penalty or any kind of infringement for being other than at that time, I think, for Carnegie.
But that damn now, Gilded Age television show is always pointing out that the Dutch colonial rich families, the Roosevelts and whatnot, are always looking down their nose at the railroad barons. But it doesn't seem to have stopped him. Well, he wasn't married, right? So he wasn't married.
Just
Andrew and his mother.
But I love the show The Gilded Age. And to your point, Carnegie's money is new money, right? But maybe he and his mother didn't care what people said about them. They were enjoying high society in New York City and all the benefits that came with it.
Right.
Briefly, just to mention, Carnegie, again, he's perfecting steel, right? And for a while, people were thinking of steel as an application for things like utensils and you know, smaller things. But Carnegie realizes, hey, steel can be used for big things like bridges. And so with his company, he's involved in the construction of the Eads Bridge, which crosses the Mississippi River and connects East St. Louis and St. Louis. And again, at the time, people weren't producing steel in large quantities, and they weren't producing the high quality steel that eventually Carnegie uses with the Bessemer process, and hiring the best engineers, making the best factories and all of that. Right. So he builds this bridge across the Mississippi, and people are not sure if it's going to hold, because there was a time when bridges actually failed somewhat frequently, unfortunately. Right. And so Carnegie builds this new library, and there's these steel triangles, and the people see all this empty space. And they say, there's no way that this bridge is going to hold. It's still there, by the way. It's still used today. People drive across it.
I've been on
it. I think most of us have in the Midwest. So Carnegie is part of a stunt with the engineer, Eads. Upon its completion in 1874, they walk a circus elephant across the bridge to satisfy any kind of fears that people in St. Louis might have had about the bridge holding, which I just think is a great story. And the Eads Bridge, it's a huge success. It's finished in 1874, and now Carnegie has proven to the world that the steel holds and it can be applied for all kinds of things, whether it's rails, bridges, buildings. And so from there, his wealth really takes off, and he becomes, between 1875 and 1900, one of the wealthiest men in American history, right?
Wow.
So he would eventually retire in 1901 at the age of 65.
Wow.
And he sold what by then was now the Carnegie Steel Company to J.P. Morgan.
Yes.
For $480 million. And then that led to the creation of U.S. Steel Corporation. So Carnegie's windfall here, or maybe not windfall, but his money is now the purchasing power today of maybe $19 billion. Okay? So no small sum.
And yet still, $19 billion would not even make him one of the 10 richest people in the world today.
Yeah, you're right. There's different ways that people can measure how influential or how wealthy someone was. One way is what we just discussed as far as the purchasing power. Sometimes an economist might say, well, what's the percentage of the national GDP as far as what they have? But you're right. No matter how you look at it, Carnegie is quite short of the wealthiest people in modern society right now.
I just looked it up here. The 10th richest person, according to Forbes, and I don't know if Forbes has any other purpose other than listing the rich people of the world, but the 10th richest person is Warren Buffett, and he's worth $150 billion. So,
yeah.
So almost 10 times as much. To get down to the $19 billion billionaires, we're probably hundreds of billionaires down.
That's crazy. I agree. The one way in that Carnegie would be analogous to the wealthiest today is that he's still just the wealthiest, and that people want to know, what are you going to do with the money? Like, in that way, it's similar, right? But as far as the purchasing power, yeah, he's well below the wealthiest people today. So,
but he's a celebrity in his time as, like, the richest.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah. Again, he's part of a class of other people. It's not just Carnegie. There's Rockefeller. There's others. But Carnegie is seen as sort of the first one to have this amount of money and also retire. And then people saying, like, well, what are you going to do with the money? Right.
Right.
So basically, he decided to devote the rest of his life to philanthropy. And over the following years, he gave away 90% of his fortune.
Now, while he was still alive.
Right. And he would leave some to a foundation that still exists today that bears his name and awards grants. But he does give away roughly 90% of his fortune.
Wow.
Either during his life or is set up an estate for the foundation. So one thing he does immediately in 1902 after he retires is he decides to buy an estate. Now, by this time in Carnegie's life, he's actually going back and visiting his native Scotland from time to time. Mm-hmm. Do you want to guess the estate that he decides to buy?
Oh, no.
Yeah,
really?
I know. It's such a baller move.
Wow.
So, I know. So Andrew Carnegie buys Pitt and Creef Estate in Dunfermline, the place where he was forbidden to enter as a child because he was part of the Morrison family.
And does he turn them out? Is there like some remnant of his old family where he's like, you're hit the bricks?
As I recall my research, by this time the estate had passed through different hands. I don't think it was the same family.
Right.
But to his credit, Carnegie makes the estate a public park.
Oh.
And so, yeah, talk about playing the long game, right? He's waits till he's, you know, 65, nearly like 50 years later or more, and decides to buy this park and give it to the town for truly everyone to enjoy.
And is it still a public park there?
I believe it is. Yeah, I was doing that. I was looking at that in my research.
That's pretty awesome.
So I think we'd also be remiss not to just for a second, because we're talking about Carnegie and his philanthropy, to just for a moment talk about detractors, right? Because Carnegie subjected people at his steel mills, including children, to dangerous work, and it was backbreaking, and the pay was quite low, especially for a non-manager employee, right? And we remember Carnegie himself was subjected to child labor and forced to quit school, right, at a young age. And now we see Carnegie himself kind of repeating that same pattern. And some people say, hey, you know, he should not have exploited children and employed children, and he could have made the working conditions safer for his own employees. There were no pensions. There were really no benefits. And so it wasn't uncommon to see men missing hands and arms and legs. And even sometimes you see this in kids. And so he's employing throughout Carnegie Steel children as young as 12 years old. Futurelings might know there was a major strike known as the Homestead Strike in 1892, where some workers at the steel factory even died. They were fighting Pinkerton security guards.
Right.
And Carnegie at the time was vacationing in Scotland, but you know, the buck stops with him. He's sort of the head of the company. Some of them died in this labor rights strike, and people see just how serious, you know, labor rights are going to be moving forward. And when Carnegie comes back and he finally sees just how bad the publicity is, again, there were multiple casualties and injuries. He has a lot of, I think what we'll see, some guilt, and we'll talk about Homestead more in just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So Carnegie sees philanthropy as a way to better society for all. And to his credit, I mean, he does a lot. We know of Carnegie Hall in New York. We know of mm-hmm. Carnegie Mellon University, of course. It was founded mm-hmm. in 1900. And as I said a moment ago, he starts a foundation. It's very interested in international peace, and that foundation is still around as well. So, mm-hmm. but for Carnegie, again, thinking about his childhood, he loves books, he loves spaces, he loves libraries. And so for him, funding the libraries is going to be the main focus. And I think it's going to be, in his mind, his legacy.
Did he have his own private library that was like extensive? Was he also a book collector?
He was, and he had another home built for the family back in Scotland as well. And there they had a very grand personal library with books.
So yeah, here we are. Now this is compatible with Marxism, these libraries. How does this come to him?
Yeah, so as we discussed, you know, he used libraries as a patron, as a young boy, and he fought for the right to use libraries, and he was inspired by them. And he saw libraries not only as a place to get books, but also he saw them as places for social gatherings, a place to have a quiet space to read a book or a newspaper, but also to meet people. You know, he was involved in debate societies. He envisioned right. libraries as places where people could have, you know, debates and, you know, and of course, you know, in a really civil way, but he believed in the town, and that's why his libraries will often be in, you know, the center of town. So the first library that Carnegie funds, and this is before he goes into his massive scheme to create thousands of libraries, but the first one he creates is in his Scottish hometown of, again, Dunfermline, Scotland. So he creates a library there. He commissions that in 1880, and it would open in 1883. And that's sort of the first one. Then he goes into Pennsylvania, where, of course, he's lived now most of his life. So the first one he commissions, it's the Braddock Carnegie Library. It's a historic public library and cultural landmark in Braddock, Pennsylvania. That opened in 1889, and it's widely recognized as the first Carnegie Library in the United States. And it's built in this medieval architecture style.
Right.
And Carnegie himself dedicated the library on March 30th, 1889. And John, you'll be glad to hear that the building is still there
yes.
and still functions as a public library today. And it is a library, but it also has a music hall, a gymnasium, swimming baths, and meeting rooms. So again, some of these crown jewel libraries, they're really more than libraries, especially
right.
the ones that are in towns that Carnegie has some sort of, you know, personal connection to.
And he's still working it out whether, you know, whether the library is going to be a kind of Acadia or whether, you know, like he hasn't quite figured out like exactly what role it's going to play in the community. This sounds like a YMCA or better.
It really does, right? Again, he envisions it as almost like the new town square, right? So next up, we go to Homestead. Of course, Homestead, Pennsylvania, there were the riots that Carnegie was associated with. And so Carnegie felt guilty about what happened at the Homestead strike. And some historians say that it really haunted him his entire life, and that building what is arguably the crown jewel of the Carnegie Libraries was his way of reconciling what happened.
Right,
so it overlooks the site of the Homestead strike itself. That's quite interesting.
Wow.
It featured a heated pool, an athletic club, and probably of interest to you, John, a music hall that still holds many concerts today.
Is the entire structure still open? Does the pool still function?
It's still open. I believe the pool still functions. I can tell you that the concert hall still functions. I was just on the website and they have, you know, bands, comedians. I don't know the exact seating, but it's a sizable venue. So
cool.
Maybe someday the Long Winters could play at the Carnegie Library, right?
Inshallah.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, it would.
Now, it's still a library today. And of course, some of the criticism at the time is that the very people Carnegie employed, you know, in these mills, they really couldn't use the libraries because they said they were worked so hard.
Right.
Now, so the first three libraries that Carnegie builds, like I just said, they're still functioning libraries. But I should note that most of the initial Carnegie libraries were in Pennsylvania. They had their own trust funds or their own endowments. And so they were not part of the town library system. And that's still true today. At first, they were owned by Carnegie Steel, and now there's a trust. So sometimes these Carnegie libraries in Pennsylvania, they're separate from truly the public system, and they would now be classified as their own nonprofit. So that's somewhat
of an... That's not true of Carnegie libraries across the United States, right?
No. Almost all of them are now, and have been from the beginning, part of the library systems in the towns. And we'll talk about in a second how towns would apply for funding and build a Carnegie library.
John, let me ask you, are these libraries being stocked with books that are coming from private donors? Or is he buying books? Is he buying across this incredible card catalog of aspirational books? Or how is he filling these libraries?
I think for the first few libraries that he's really funding, he's giving some money to books, but really not a lot. So once he opens up the process for people to apply for basically a grant to build a library, that's one of Carnegie's conditions. He says, look, I'm going to give you the money to build the capital, the actual building of the library, but you, the town, you need to promise that you can generate enough tax revenue to operate the library moving forward, but also you need to supply your own books. I'm not giving you the books.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. He's supplying the space and not the books. Yeah.
Get your own books. I kind of love that though. That makes a lot of sense, right?
Right. I think so.
Yeah. Because the books then would, and I mean, one expects would reflect the community to a certain degree.
Yeah.
I wonder, John, do you have the answer to this question, which is that the rise of public libraries must have suddenly created a demand for books in a way that hadn't previously existed. Books would have been kind of items that you would have to be somebody with enough money and leisure time to spend them on books. But now all of a sudden, a successful book would make its way to, it would have buyers around the country and around the world.
I think it had to create a huge demand for books. Absolutely. So it must have affected the publishing industry, how many people were aspiring to be authors, for sure. And you got to give Carnegie some credit for that. We can talk at the end, is Carnegie the hero or the villain, or is he somewhere in between? But yeah, I mean, he's definitely, really making a case for the idea that everyone can read a book and should read a book and should have access to books. And
right.
Of course, that creates demand for more authors and more publications, right? Carnegie has his first few pilot libraries that we just discussed. And then turn of the century, Carnegie says, hey, I want to open up a system where communities can apply for grants to build their own library. Again, not the books, just the building. And he says to people, to towns, hey, you can hire your own architect. You can get your own contractor. It's interesting. These libraries, they're not the Sears catalog where every town gets the same library, like the same Lego set. Towns have a lot of ability to, again, decide what they want as far as the architectural design, who the architect is. They're often built and designed to account for natural light and function. So there's some, utilitarian aspect to it, but they are also just beautiful buildings. I mean, we can probably all picture in our minds a Carnegie Library. They're often in that Beaux Arts architectural style. Again, Carnegie sees these places to serve to inspire people. So they should be beautiful in his mind. It's really important to get across. Towns, again, as I just said, they need to provide the funding to operate the library. Carnegie enlisted his trusted assistant, James Bertram, to field questions for the library funding. And so if a town applied, their odds of approval, John, were very, very high. Almost all of these applications, as far as we know, are getting accepted. So Bertram, he would ask for the town population size. He would ask about what's the site for the library that you have in mind. And again, it was very hard to get denied. If you could say that you were going to find the tax money, Bertram and then Carnegie would usually approve your application.
Can you imagine a better job than being the person who is standing between an incredibly wealthy man who wants to do good and all of the towns of America, and being able to say, you get a library and you get a library? Like, what a great, what a way to spend your life.
It'd be a great job. If any rich philanthropist right now wants to hire me to help do that kind of work today, I'm certainly interested. You can find me.
Even put like a water park in every town. Like, let me build you a water park. Right. These days, you know, a library might not connect with people, but a water park.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's important to note Carnegie did not insist on his name being on the libraries. Now, some do. Sometimes you will see the name Carnegie included on the front of the library. If that's the case, that was the town insisting that they wanted to do that. But Carnegie in no way required that. And oftentimes it doesn't. Sometimes it will just say public library or the name of the town and library. Again, Carnegie's own steelworker suggested that his wealth would be better spent improving working conditions for his own employees,
right,
rather than building libraries across the country. And to that, Carnegie replied, "If I had raised your wages, you would have spent that money buying a better cut of meat or more drink for your dinner. But what you needed, though you didn't know it, was my libraries and concert halls."
Take that, people who want a better cut of meat.
Right.
Well, let me ask you. So Bertram is asking, how big is your town?
Yeah.
Does that mean that he's got a scale? His budget varies. If you've got a 600 person town versus a 600,000 person town, how is he making that determination?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes he would push back and say, what's the true demand for your town? What's the projection for how much it might grow in the next few decades? But again, Carnegie's wealth was just so large that he could really fund almost all of his libraries. So let me just tell you some of the numbers. This might help you understand. Carnegie funded the construction of 2,509 libraries between 1883 and 1929, making his library program one of the largest philanthropic building efforts in history. So again, over 2,500, and that's worldwide. It's a lot of libraries.
It's got to be one of the biggest public works. I mean, that rivals the Roman roads.
It really does. It's an amazing accomplishment. We'll see if you still feel that way when we get to the end and we learn about how these libraries are operating today. So here's the breakdown. So within the United States, about 1,679 libraries. And that number doesn't even include the nearly 100 university libraries that Carnegie gave funding for.
Oh,
right?
No way.
Yeah. So gave money to about 100 universities for their academic libraries. But as far as towns, again, about 1,679.
So you're saying there's 900 libraries that aren't in the United States.
Correct. Now there's about 660 in the United Kingdom and Ireland. There's about 125 in Canada. These are mostly the English-speaking world, although not entirely. There's some in Australia, some in New Zealand, and even small numbers. So countries like South Africa, Serbia, Belgium, France, Malaysia, Fiji. So they're kind of all over, but those are sort of one-offs. They're mostly in the English-speaking world and mostly in the United States.
And are they connected by any kind of network? Are they coordinated? If you're in Malaysia and you have a Carnegie Library there, does it have access to the collections of other Carnegie libraries?
That's a great question. I would have to guess no, given the time, that it would have been really hard to communicate, but I really can't say for certain. That's a great question.
Yeah, right. If you sent a letter, or if your librarian sent a letter to New York City, would they send you a book that they couldn't find?
Yeah, kind of like how a public system would today if there were different branches, right?
I
want to say probably not, although it's a great question. Okay, let's drill down on the United States. So most U.S. states and territories won at least one Carnegie Library grant. Even Hawaii, of course, a territory, had one grant, and the library still stands today. So there were only two states with no Carnegie libraries. One was Delaware, no Carnegie Library. John, do you want to guess the second state that doesn't have a Carnegie Library?
I know. Because if there was a Carnegie Library in the great state of Alaska, I'd already be aware of it.
Yeah, it was Alaska. So none for
Delaware,
Alaska.
Delaware. But I guess Delaware is so small that they can go to the Carnegie Libraries in Philadelphia or Baltimore or Washington, D.C. They don't need one of their own. Is that the logic?
That could have been it. Maybe no one thought to apply in Delaware. Maybe they had the funding on their own. I really don't know. But yeah, Delaware and Alaska. I thought you'd enjoy that.
Yeah, that's a little hard. But
some good news. Washington State was awarded 44 libraries from Carnegie.
And
go on.
Well, so I can see, you know, the city of Seattle, which I know has a handful of libraries, or, you know, a half a dozen more just in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I can see Seattle booming town, and they always had a pretty high opinion of themselves. And towns like Bellingham and Olympia, sure, but like, how were they able to even find that many wide spots in the road in Washington in 1902?
That's a great question. I think that they're maybe still ahead of time as far as zoning, and they maybe have the space, but that was a requirement, and Carnegie probably wasn't going to fund your library if it was nowhere near the town. I mean,
How many did you say? 40?
44 libraries within Washington State.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll talk about Olympia near the end.
You know what that feels like? That feels like an incredible road trip.
It does.
I'm going to visit every Carnegie Library in Washington State. That just feels like, because to visit everyone in the United States would be, you know, that's just one of those walk around the world things. How would you even do it? But to spend like a week and just driving around Washington, like all you have to do is kind of touch the front door and then you've had a sandwich there or whatever, and on you go.
It'd be a great local road trip weekend for sure.
It would.
My home state of Indiana was awarded the most library grants, 165 library grants from Carnegie to the state of Indiana. But the point is that they are everywhere, and I'd be willing to bet that most future liens, in the United States at least, live relatively close to a Carnegie Library or a former site of a Carnegie Library. Well, John, let me ask you this. Out of the 1,679 Carnegie Library buildings that were constructed in the United States, how many do you think are both still standing but also still function as libraries today?
That's a good question. Just as a side note, I just Googled how many towns are in Indiana, and although there are 447 like municipal town governments, there are only 120 incorporated cities, meaning almost every incorporated city in Indiana has a Carnegie Library.
It seems like the governor or someone at that time in Indiana knew about the Carnegie Library application, and they insisted that every mayor in town maybe apply for the library to get the free ones. I'm not sure.
But in answer to your question, here in Seattle, and I know you intend to get to Washington State. I don't want to leap ahead. But we had the biggest one, the greatest one, a library that should still, you know, live as the center of the city, was torn down. And torn down during that era of like, this building's musty. We're going to tear it down and build a mid-century modern piece of garbage. And then they tore that down and built a space station in its place.
Oh.
And there's one library in Ballard that's like a nightclub.
We're going to talk about Ballard. That's on my list.
But I know the one in the University District is still a library. Mm-hmm. And I think the one in by Garfield High School on 23rd is still a library. So I'm guessing a third of them are no longer libraries, were torn down or no longer work.
So our best estimate out of the 1,679 is that about 750 are still libraries. So about 44%, as far as we can tell. These numbers, they change a little bit over time, but about 44% are still libraries. And again, they were all built mostly about 100 years ago, maybe little bit more than that. So that's where we're at right now.
And how many of those do the buildings still stand, but they've been repurposed, and how many of them were just torn down?
Yeah, great question. So at least 243 have just been demolished. They're gone to history. They're gone forever. It's likely that at least a few more than that, but it's at least 15% are just gone, right? Either the town neglected it and decided it was best to build a new library that was more modern. The repair and the upkeep, you know, can be expensive for these older buildings. So again, 15% at least are just gone. And then others are now either in private hands or still in public hands, but serve as things other than libraries.
So people have bought Carnegie libraries and turned them into private homes?
There's a home in Massachusetts. Yeah, there's a couple homes. So it's also important to note that you're asking about how many of them are still libraries. Part of the reason that the libraries fell into disrepair was that towns, they basically lied on their applications, right? So they were inflating their population numbers. They were overestimating, sometimes in good faith, sometimes in bad, how much tax revenue they could generate for the library. And so sometimes it was only 10 years later where they built this library and it was apparent that the library was just way too big for the town.
Right.
And sometimes you have the opposite problem where the town exploded in growth and the library was just far too small for the town. And again, it was in a place where it was hard to add additions because it was in the middle of downtown, or by that time, more buildings had sprung up. And so it was hard to add on to the library. So if some of these libraries within 10, 15 years, they're kind of useless to serve as libraries.
Which is interesting because the Great Depression would have been, you know, 30 years later, right? And I would assume that in a time like that, a public library would have been a real boon in a lot of places, just given that it's a form of entertainment that's free to everybody. And it seems very, you know, Works Progress Administration coded to overuse that coded appellation. But you know what I mean? Like, I think of libraries as being public libraries and public works as being this kind of 30s concept of like what a city or a town would rally around.
That's a great point. And I think that the libraries truly did provide those benefits to most of the towns for a decent period of time. I think the question for us now, if we're trying to grade or evaluate how good this philanthropy was, you have to consider if half the libraries are no longer there and it's only 100 years later, is that good enough or not? Like, that's subjective. People can answer that themselves.
Right.
But then, of course, when you talk about them falling into public or other public uses or in private hands. So some libraries over time were sold by local governments. Notably, there's a Carnegie... what's called the Carnegie Library to Pub phenomenon.
Oh, and no way. It's actually a thing?
It's a thing. So some libraries, they become, you know, library annexes or the mayor's office or all kinds of public things. But often when they're sold to private interest, they become pubs. It's a thing, the Carnegie Library to Pub phenomenon. And wow. It kind of makes sense because Carnegie libraries, they have high ceilings. They're often located in, again, central downtown area where people like to gather. People might now live in subdivisions. If they go downtown, it might be fun to go to the old Carnegie Library building and, you know, have a nice meal and have a drink. Right. And they're cool buildings. One example of this is right by me. So what is the old Mishawaka Library? Mishawaka is the town just next to South Bend. There's a very popular restaurant called the Jesus Latin Bar and Grill. Shout out to Jesus. But it's sort of like this hipster restaurant that people love to go to. And it, again, it still retains a lot of the charm of the library. The second floor, it's used for private events, but they keep bookshelves up there. And they have what appear to be books, but they're actually the fake books. Like when you see the plastic, you know, right, book linings at IKEA or somewhere, it's not real books. They have those up there. But to their credit, they keep that library atmosphere, and it's kind of neat. Also within Indiana, in Carmel, Indiana, I was at this restaurant a few months ago. It's called Woody's. And it's, again, it's in this beautiful library in Carmel, Indiana. good restaurant, you know, great food. And so you see, again, the bookcases, the general setting, you feel like you are in the past and you appreciate the past. And so those are some of the examples of the library to pub. And we'll talk about a couple in Washington State in just a moment.
So are these buildings that are still owned by the city and leased by these clubs, or are people, I mean, because some of these clubs seem a little, although cool, like the building is out of scale of the business. Are
it can
they
be
really
both.
Really?
It's usually sold. So I'll give you one example at the very end of one that is leased, but it's usually sold. It's usually the town has the power legally to sell the building. Carnegie didn't have any strict gift agreement or grant agreement that said you need to hold this library for 500 years or in perpetuity. He wasn't thinking that way. So the towns have the legal authority to sell the libraries, and often they want to just flat out sell it, then lease it, because they want to rid their hands of it, because again, of the maintenance, the upkeep. So it's usually it's going to be a sale. Some of the Carnegie libraries become hotels. They're small hotels, of course. They might have, you know, 3 rooms, 5 rooms, at most 8, but there are a couple of hotels. There's one being renovated into a hotel or a bed and breakfast right now, just north of me in St. Joseph, Michigan. I look forward to going and checking that out when it's done next year. Again, you asked about homes. So yeah, there's a famous one in Rockport, Massachusetts, where a private individual family bought a home. It looks beautiful. So they used that architecture and they made a beautiful home out of it. Another one near me in Niles, Michigan, is now a comedy club. So again, you can see they're doing everything. Okay. Another example, in Moline, Illinois, a Carnegie library, it's now, it's called the Sound Conservatory, a music school piano showroom. You see a couple of those too. They kind of make sense for music. Again, they're beautiful buildings. They have high ceilings. You can think of the acoustics as being relatively okay. And so that's also a common thing. So on to Seattle. So the Ballard Carnegie Library, one of the most interesting surviving Carnegie Library era buildings in the Northwest. So it was built in 1904 in what then was the independent town of Ballard.
Right.
Yes, that's not part of Seattle at that point. It was a $15,000 grant from Carnegie and also some local funding. And the architect, Henderson Ryan, it's a fairly classic idea. It's a neoclassical revival style of library. Mm-hmm. Beautiful brick, raised foundation, prominent entrance. Again, 1904. It would become part of the Seattle Public Library system after Ballard was annexed in 1907. And it served as the neighborhood library for 60 years. So 60 years, had a good run, and it closed in 1963 when the larger modern branch replaced it. So it was considered too small and outdated. It was a rapidly growing neighborhood. I've been to Ballard. You can tell just how that community exploded in growth, you know, in the mid-century. So Seattle voters approved for a replacement library. After it's a library, it goes through some phases of things. For a while, it's an antique store, mm-hmm. which also makes sense, mm-hmm. right? You can envision a Carnegie Library being a fun antique store. Mm-hmm. It was also a restaurant, including at one time a French restaurant called Carnegie's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was then consulting offices, a wellness business, and today it is a pub, mm-hmm. and it is the Kangaroo and Kiwi Pub. It has been that since 2012. It's an Australian and New Zealand themed bar. And on the front, it still says Carnegie Free Public Library. I want to tell you about two other Washington State libraries, John. So the first is the Olympia Carnegie Library. It's an L-shaped plan, which you often see these, a raised foundation, formal stairs, prominent classical entry. On the front is carved public library, and it's sort of this brick and terracotta exterior. Again, neoclassical, it's built, it's beautiful. It's about almost 10,000 square feet, and for a while, function. So it was the library from 1914 to 1978. So again, pretty good run. Upper floors as well. Served as Olympia's main public library for also more than 60 years. They expanded it in 1960 as it became too small for the growing city, but it was replaced in 1978 for a new facility. Now, afterward, the library would be used for different things. So for a while, a bookstore, which again, that makes sense, right? Bookstore.
Yep.
Then it's a restaurant.
for a while, it becomes a church. I'm not sure which denomination, but it was a church for a while.
You could see that too, yeah.
You could see that. And then for a while, it's office and mixed commercial space. But most recently, it is undergoing a redevelopment into a hospitality club concept. And it's referred to as the Carnegie Whiskey Library,
which aims
to preserve interior historic features like woodwork fireplaces and even old service elements like a dumbwaiter. But they're currently renovating that right now. So if listeners want to make a field trip over to Olympia, and at some point in your future, it's going to be basically, from what I can tell, a whiskey bar. Okay, yeah. On to Everett.
Yeah.
So Carnegie funds the Everett Library, $25,000 in 1903-4. It opens in 1905 as Everett's main public library. Served during a period when Everett was growing rapidly in lumber, you know, industrial city. And like many libraries, it became too small pretty quickly. So by the early 1930s, the space is overcrowded. It had an auditorium, like a lot of Carnegie libraries. They were using the auditorium to stack books, and it was a children's reading area. So it really was a cramped space. So in 1934, Everett opened a new library downtown, and the Carnegie Library closed in 1935. So it really didn't have a very good run. It only had about 30 years. Now, after its time as a library, you'll appreciate this, or you'll find this interesting. Between 1935 and 1980, you don't know what this was, do you?
No.
Growing up in the area, you don't know. So it's a funeral home from 1935 to 1980.
Wow.
The Cassidy Funeral Home. Yeah, yeah. One of the most peculiar examples, it's a funeral home for a while. It's currently the Carnegie Resource Center, and it actually helps some nonprofits with social services, things like that. So it's still doing some good work all this time later, although, again, it was a funeral home for a while. Okay, now our last example, we're going to go from Washington State to Washington, D.C., okay?
Mm-hmm.
So D.C., they won 4 library grants from Carnegie. 3 of the 4, they're still libraries, but the Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C., in what is Mount Vernon Square, is one of the most famous examples of a Carnegie Library being transformed into a modern retail space. So it opened in 1903, again, funded by Carnegie, designed by Ackerman and Ross. It's Beaux Arts. It's a civic monument. It's really just a stunningly large, beautiful building. Carnegie gave D.C., at that time, $250,000 to build just these 4 libraries. So it was sort of their system. Yeah. And the one that we're talking about now, it's the crown jewel. Go on.
That library is so gorgeous. It really is. There's an element of it that almost is Roman, sort of Roman Empire. It's got, it's got archways. And I just feel it feels very much like something you would see in Rome.
Mm-hmm. One interesting note is that the Modern Giving Pledge, which was formally announced in 2010 by Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, where they're pledging to give away, you know, at least half of their wealth, they actually went to this library in Mount Vernon to have an event and make this announcement. So they're sort of using the library as a backdrop and, you know, citing Carnegie's own philanthropy as an inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
By 2016, the Mount Vernon DC Library was destined for a new chapter. It is now in the hands of a private company, and it's leased. It's not owned. But, John, do you want to guess which company has control of this beautiful library in Mount Vernon?
Company? What company? Amazon? Are they using it as a distribution center?
That would be pretty bad. It's not Amazon.
Who could afford it? I mean, it couldn't have been turned into, like, offices for Google. I have no idea.
Okay, so it's Apple.
Apple, what are they doing?
It's now an Apple store, has the logo and everything. I'm looking up.
Oh my God, you're kidding. An Apple store?
So in 2016, in 2016, Apple signed a long-term agreement to restore and lease part of the building. So they don't occupy the entire space, but they have the prime space in the building. Because it's such a big space, there's still a DC History Museum. There's research exhibitions about the Washington library history and even about Carnegie himself and the libraries. But Apple controls the store, and there's a neon Apple sign on the front of the building.
You know, the way Apple stores are built, that are just like giant open spaces, tables, but they often had really tall ceilings. They feel cavernous, and they're meant to inspire awe. You can see the rotunda of a library being. I could see it as an Apple store. I'm very curious about the lighting in there.
Yeah, I've never been in person. I'm dying to go. So next time I'm in the Beltway, I'm going to have to go to the Apple store. This leads us to the question is just how effective Carnegie's philanthropy was. You know, these libraries, they're buildings and they tumble as buildings almost always do. And so without question, they help people discover books and become more educated in an era of American history when books and inspiring public spaces were still, you know, somewhat uncommon. By the time the last grant was made to Canton, Kansas in 1921, which is still a library today, Carnegie had funded the construction of nearly half of the 3,500 libraries in the United States. So half the libraries, you know, one man funded, which is quite interesting. So I'd encourage future leans to find their nearest Carnegie library and either check out a book or possibly, who knows, enjoy a nice meal.
In terms of rating the Carnegie libraries, the success of them on how well they're still performing 100 years later, I think a lot of the 19th century big projects, big improvement projects in the U.S., they had their time. And, you know, eventually people moved on. Or if you think about the infrastructure that went into radio, for instance, that now is, or telephones, the fact that every house in the United States was wired for a telephone, and then that whole system is gone. Yeah, I think that if over half of them are still functioning as libraries, it's a massive success.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Again, it's not perfect, but you have to admire the fact that he wanted to inspire reading and, again, have people have access to public places that were both beautiful and open to everybody. And so, yeah, I think overall it's a win.
In the U.S., of course, Carnegie and Rockefeller are used as examples both by people that believe in the accumulation of wealth as kind of an American principle, and you can be a wealthy person and look at what these big wealthy individuals are capable of doing. They improve the lives of so many. It's in some ways it's the trickle down theory of economics. And they're also these guys, Rockefeller and Carnegie in particular, are pointed to as examples of robber barons and, you know, rapacious industrialists that not only don't allow their workers to have a finer cut of meat because they have these lofty ambitions, but Carnegie is judged both as an American hero and also as a forerunner to a kind of criminal accumulator. Like, how do you rate him as an American?
Yeah, I mean, his legacy is both, right? He's the guy who generated just so much wealth off of the backs and the safety of people, including children. And you can't overlook that when you think about, you know, children at these steel mills, like, you know, losing hands or limbs. It's just so repugnant to us today, right? So I don't want to give him a pass and be like, give him an A-, like he built these libraries. I think it's really hard to judge anyone, I think, looking back, you know, a century or more. So you get the sense that he believes in the power of education and he put his money behind it. But then, like anyone else, I wrestle thinking about some of the harm he did to people and families, right? As far as the wages or just, again, back to the safety issues. So it's really hard.
I mean, I also struggle with the idea that in order to build nice things, we have to extract that money from the world and filter it through the mind and ambition of one man who then converts it into kinetic energy according to his whim. It's just in this case, yeah, he put libraries in every town. That's pretty rad.
Right. Yeah, it is pretty rad. And you can tell that he wrestled throughout his life. Once he accumulated a pretty good amount of money, he wrestled with the idea of, what do I do with this? How do I, you know, make the world a better place? And so you have to respect and admire that. And he did what he thought was the best use, you know, of his money. And so that's that's what history gives us. There's very rarely is someone totally the hero or totally the villain, and Carnegie's no exception to that.
And that concludes Carnegie Libraries, entry 188.LU2101, certificate number 39770, in the omnibus. Futurelings, as you know, both John and I and all good Marxists do not want you to waste your lives consuming the largely AI-generated propaganda that now pervades all social media. So avoid social media. Are you on social media, John?
Not really, no.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's overrated.
It's terrible. So stay away from it, except for places where futurelings congregate, and they do across all social media. So just go there, dip your toe in the water, and search for futurelings, and you'll find like-minded fans. You can find accounts for us at Omnibus Project. You can go to YouTube, although this show won't be on YouTube. We had a little bit of a snafu halfway through. But you can find almost all other Omnibus episodes of the 2.0 version on youtube.com/@ The Omnibus Project. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. And you can go to our website, omnibusproject.com/submit. And like John, submit a proposal for a show. Also, you can send us mail to The Omnibus Project, 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. And finally, our show is listener-supported, so please join us and the other listeners who support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. There are lots and lots of marvelous things there on our Patreon page. Tons of extra content. Ken and I did, 8 years worth of monthly bonus episodes where we answer viewer mail. I continue to do those, the last two co-hosted by my daughter. And also there are episodes now where we have a more lengthy conversation with our guest host. John and I talked for about a half an hour before we recorded this. So you get to know the co-hosts a lot better. So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.